This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin the show with a dark anniversary. 1 year ago today, Hurricane Maria slammed into Puerto Rico. The powerful and deadly storm damaged hundreds of thousands of homes, knocked out power across the island for months. According to the Puerto Rican government, the updated death toll is just shy of 3,000, making it one of the deadliest storms in U.S. history. WBUR's Simon Rios reported from Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Maria, and he's back on the island this week and joins us now from San Juan. Simon, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Thanks a lot, Anthony. It's good to be here.
So give us a sense of what you've been seeing since you've been back and how it compares to what you saw last year right after Maria hit.
The first thing you see when you land, you know, having as a point of comparison being here right after the storm, is that the green has returned to this tropical island. When we were here before, it just, the entire place felt brown, and now the vegetation is back. That's the first thing. But as you talk to people, you realize more and more how much work there is to go, as you can hear.
As if on cue.
Right. But I got to say, you know, it really depends on where you go and who you talk to. Much of San Juan really seems back to normal. It's hard to tell anything happened. But that is not true for the countryside. And it's also not true for neighborhoods in San Juan, more working class neighborhoods, where they really haven't seen a lot of help. And where entire houses are still destroyed, abandoned even, and where people are really just hanging on for a thread.
Yeah, so a lot of work left to do. Now, the updated death toll from the Puerto Rican government, 2,975, much higher than the original estimate of just 64. How are people mm-hmm. reacting to this number? It must confirm what many already knew.
It does. You know, if you consider that Puerto Rico has one of the oldest populations in the United States, and as I said before, the number of people who depend on electricity for their health care, you know, this is where the greatest number of people died after the storm, from the lack of electricity. You know, and to add to this, a lot of medical personnel left the island. And, you know, with difficulty getting certain medications, that's where a lot of the deaths occurred. We spoke to a guy on background who works at the VA in San Juan, and he told me that every day after the storm, he would see lines of refrigerated trucks lined up outside the morgue. And so at this time, I think the government's official death toll was 16. And it was obvious to him and to many other people that the real numbers were going to be much different. Pedro Adorno is the head of a community theater collective in San Juan. Here's what he told us about going around the island in the weeks and months after the storm.
We knew a lot of hospitals were without electricity, people who don't got cancer treatment, people who got kidney problems. We feel that, but they denied the information.
So, Simone, are people still having trouble getting help from the federal government, from FEMA, from the Federal Disaster Agency?
This is a huge problem in Puerto Rico right now. Many people who say that they have legitimate claims say they've been denied for one reason or another. But at the same time, we should point out that FEMA says it's carried out one of the largest recovery efforts in its history.
So what's the general mood? What's the general attitude towards the federal government and FEMA on the island in general?
It really depends on who you talk to. You know, a lot of people feel abandoned, and others are thankful that they got any help at all, you know, even if it wasn't enough to make them whole, especially because they know neighbors who didn't get anything. We met Jose Contreras in the same neighborhood we were talking about before while he was rebuilding his house.
Aquí se dispararon los precios por una cosa increíble.
Contreras told us that he had to struggle with FEMA and that he was rejected at first, but he appealed and eventually got the maximum amount of just over $33,000. The problem is the price of materials here, as you can imagine, has skyrocketed. Also, in his case, he's able to do the work himself, but a lot of the people here, you know, don't have those skills or don't have other people who can help them. So when you consider all of these factors, help from FEMA just isn't enough. And, you know, that's if you get any help at all.
Now, you've also spoken to some experts about the reconstruction process and what that could mean for Puerto Rico. What are people saying about that?
This is a big deal right now in Puerto Rico. Tens of billions of dollars set to come in for the reconstruction effort. And people are concerned about where that money's going to go. It seems like everybody's talking about it. It could be an opportunity to turn things around and really stimulate the economy, or not. I met with José Caraballo Cueto. He's a well-known economist on the island. You know, he described Puerto Rico as going through a Great Depression since 2006. And he says all the disaster money set to come in could either help Puerto Rico turn around or further contribute to the inequality that already exists here.
Well, that's WBUR's Simon Rios reporting from San Juan, Puerto Rico, on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria hitting that island. Simon, thanks so much. We look forward to talking to you in the days ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up, Mark Leibovich on his new book, Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Mark Leibovich is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He covers politics, presidents. He lives in Washington, but he has local roots here. Born in Boston, he went to Newton South High School, and he's a lifelong Patriots fan, though he admits that being a New England sports fan is not without its embarrassments. Leibovich has a new book all about the NFL, the good, the bad, the ugly about the league. He writes about the Billionaires' Owners Club, how Donald Trump wanted to join it but couldn't and had to settle for the White House instead. And he writes about the stars, including Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. The book is called Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. He'll be talking about it this evening at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, and he joins us now. Mark, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
And I want to invite listeners into this conversation. We want to hear from you. Are you a football fan by birth? What do you make of the NFL? What questions do you have about the NFL? Are you concerned about player concussions, about long-term brain damage? Are you a Tom Brady fan? Will he just play forever? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection with Mark Leibovich about his book, The Big Game. So, as we mentioned, you've spent most of your career in journalism focusing on politics. Why football?
Well, I needed a break from politics.
Understandable.
I've been doing that nonstop for 16, 17 years. The last campaign was pretty grueling. And I've always loved football. And I wrote a book on D.C. about 5 years ago called This Town that was sort of about the end of the empire in Washington. Or not the end of the empire, but a moment when Washington seemed to be getting sort of fat and happy. And it just felt like it was teetering on something. And then all of a sudden, Donald Trump gets elected, and we have this whole new chapter and moment in Washington. Football was the same thing. It's this incredibly successful, prosperous, popular sport that seemed to be in a very precarious moment. Just there's a lot going on. I wanted to just jump in and sort of see what the similarities were, and it turned out to be just the same swamp or a different swamp, but very very familiar to the world I operate in day-to-day.
Interesting. So swampy, like the nation's capital in many ways.
In some ways, very incestuous, insular, wealthy, ego-driven, in many ways, male-driven, power-driven, and a lot of the same demons.
And speaking of that, a big part of your book talks about these NFL owners, the membership, as they call themselves, and it's basically a billionaires' boys' club.
Absolutely.
So how do you describe these guys beyond that?
Well, I mean, I was fairly unimpressed with them. I mean, these are one of the great surprises to me is that one of the great undercovered stories in sports is these 32 really, really wealthy, often quite smaller-than-life people who own these 32 teams. And these are just coveted entities and often the most powerful entertainment entity in individual communities. And they make tons of money. And yet, obviously, Donald Trump is a great example of someone who could not get into their club. And yet they are, as one of the co-owners, Steve Tisch of the New York Giants said, it's billionaires. It's junior high school for billionaires. And you realize that, like, they have these meetings and they have all these incredibly mutual suspicions and rivalries and just these pettinesses between them. And And yet they control the destinies of so many communities, and they're reviled in so many towns. So it's the membership, they call themselves.
The membership, yeah. Now, why couldn't Donald Trump get into this club? What did he do to try to get into it, and why did he fail?
He did a number of things. He's been trying for 4 decades. He owned a USFL team in the 1980s, the New Jersey Generals, with hopes of maybe merging into the NFL. The fact is, a lot of these business people who own NFL teams have dealt with him in business over the years. They wanted no part of being business partners with him. A lot of them thought he was a clown. And, you know, he made an effort to buy the Patriots in the 80s, made an effort to buy the Buffalo Bills in 2014. And just think, if he had gotten the Buffalo Bills, he could own the Buffalo Bills. And his fellow owners would have to worry about something else besides the White House.
Yeah, but, really interesting. Now, in some ways, Trump has sort of declared war on the NFL. He's focused his anger on these players who've been taking a knee during the national anthem. I mean, do you think his inability to sort of join the membership has somehow fueled this ongoing feud with
the
NFL?
It has to. It has to be. It's sort of an added sweetener to this. I mean, I think, look, he thinks it's a good political issue for him. He thinks just sort of periodically saying that players need to stand for the national anthem is big with his base. He thinks it's a popular view in the country, and polls would probably back him up on that. But ultimately, the NFL fits very much into the category of institutions that had not over the years wanted Donald Trump as a member. He had his nose pressed up against the glass, and they just always wanted to keep him at a distance. So that's an added sweetener.
It's so interesting. It's so part of the Donald Trump story. I mean, you could say the same thing about sort of his political ascent, that desire to sort of get out from having his nose pressed up against the glass and be on the inside.
Be accepted.
He managed to get to the White House, but not into the membership of the NFL.
It is an amazing story in some ways. I mean, obviously for reasons that have been told to death and will be told through history. Yeah. But, I mean, look, this is the Queens, you know, bridge and tunnel guy who wanted to be the elite Manhattan real estate developer and who was never really accepted by the polite society of New York and real estate. And it's just sort of football is sort of the exact same paradigm with him. And, but now he gets the ultimate consolation trophy sitting in the White House and heckling the owners.
Right? Mark Leibovich, he's author of Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times. We're taking your calls, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Brockton. Go ahead, Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
No problem. You know, I'm always amazed how every discussion ends up with Trump, no matter what we're talking about. But nevertheless, you know, the agreement between the NFLPA and the league is going to be ending in a few years. I'm just wondering what your attitude is. Do you think the players will be bought off again like they were last time, with more time off and less practicing, when they want to have these other things like less control by the commissioner and social justice issues? Or you think that they finally will bite the bullet, like MLB players did and like the NBA players did, and take some work stoppage in order to get more money and more equity for themselves?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think the next CBA, collective bargaining agreement negotiations, which comes up, I think, in 2 years, is going to be just pivotal, because beyond like player discipline things, which gets a lot of attention, and obviously the right to protest and things involving freedom of speech and so forth. I mean, the idea of guaranteed contracts, I think, is something that is extremely and increasingly important to NFL players. The NFL is the only major professional league in the United States that doesn't guarantee the contracts for its players, except for in a few cases. And that, to me, is like a game changer in many ways. I think Martellus Bennett, the former Patriots player, who I was on his podcast. He has a podcast out in L.A. last week. And he was saying that he used to protest during the national anthem by raising his fist. And he said a lot of his teammates, especially later on with the Packers, said that they would do something like that too, but they had zero job security. And I think that that's going to be a real cornerstone issue, because I think NFL players see how their fellow athletes in other sports just basically get the job security that they don't.
Thanks for that call. Mark, I want to talk, since we're in Boston talking to a greater Boston audience, I want to talk about the Patriots and Tom Brady. You don't pull any punches here. You make it very clear that you're a diehard Patriots fan, even though you bring a sort of real critical eye to this. But I love what you write about your fandom. You write, being a sports fan, generally speaking, can require a faith blind and durable. Being a Boston fan has made this easier in some ways with our gaudy prosperity of late. But the birthright is not without embarrassments. I love that. Can you just talk a little bit about what it means for you to be a Patriots fan?
Yeah. Okay. Just to step back, I wouldn't trade being a fan of this team with any other team in the league. And I'm sure there are many teams in the league that would trade being a Patriots fan right. because, look, no one has won as much as we have in this century, and good for us. And, I mean, I'm sure we are very quick to remind fans of other teams of our success. But having said that, we do lead the league in crosses to bear. I mean, these sort of gate scandals, whether it's Spygate or Deflategate, I mean, they do take a big toll around the country. You do have to apologize for a lot of things that you might not necessarily want to have to defend, whether it's Bill Belichick's brusque manner at the podium or perhaps the the arrogance of certain fans. I would never include myself in that. or the conduct of Robert Kraft. I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, Tom Brady is not the most likable guy outside of New England either. There are a lot of things that are going to be abused and questioned and so forth. So, yeah, you do have to sort of hold your breath a little bit and say, yes, we're on the right side here. But ultimately, the New England Patriots, I think, are hated and resented in a way that other dynasties in football history, whether the Pittsburgh Steelers or the San Francisco 49ers, have not been.
Is that just because they've won so much and they're so dominant, or there's something else going on there?
No, because other teams have won almost as much.
Right.
I think there is something else going on there. I think part of it is social media. I think part of it is today's dynasty. It's also lasted a lot longer than Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Green Bay, I mean, any of these dynasties. I mean, it's gone for 18, 19 years. They are just there. And it's also, it coincides with an era of media saturation where there are so many games on TV, and the Patriots, I mean, I know this as someone who doesn't live in Boston, I live in Washington. I mean, I can watch them for free, which is nice, all the time because they're just all over the place. So people are sick of them. And then you have a divisive figure like Donald Trump adopting them as his own, which, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, is going to create great friction and baggage and divisiveness around your team, whether you want it or not. So, again, there's a lot of noise around the Patriots that can become exhausting if you want to be defensive about
it. Right. I want to ask you about your experience of sort of tracking down Tom Brady and actually finally getting an interview with him. And as you're on your way to his fabulous penthouse apartment in Manhattan, you actually admit that you're sort of more nervous with the prospect of meeting Tom Brady than you ever have been as you've spoken to presidents or whoever else it is.
It was a bizarre thing. I mean, I have interviewed presidents, I've interviewed CEOs, I've interviewed even interviewed the former host of The Apprentice. I mean, I legitimately like within a few months of this first interview I had with Brady, I spent three solid weeks, or not three solid weeks, but a long time, you know, talking to then front runner Donald Trump. But yeah, being in the presence of your childhood hero or someone that you associate with a childhood pursuit, whether it's pro football, was amazing. I was just really nervous walking in there, and I was sweating, and I hope I didn't like completely embarrass myself.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I was telling you this before we went on the air. You know, I've been able to talk to a few sort of powerful folks as well, and not long ago I was at an event for WBUR, and I was in the green room with Pedro Martinez, and I was suddenly like just this blob of jello. It's like, oh my God, you're Pedro Martinez. I can't believe it.
It is. You revert to being like a 7-year-old, you know, again. I mean, there was a bizarre, I mean, it is amazing. I remember, I write about this in the book, going to the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies a couple years ago in Canton, Ohio, and all the gold jackets, all the inductees come back. And Tony Dorsett, who I remember, you know, seeing when I was growing up, Hall of Fame running back for the Dallas Cowboys, I just ran right up to him and said, I'll never forget seeing that 99-yard run from scrimmage you had on Monday Night Football against Minnesota. And he came right back and he said, yes, of course. There were only 10 men on the field, you know, because Ron Springs, the fullback, was confused, and he wound up, he didn't come onto the field. And by the way, that record can never be broken. It can only be tied because, of course, you cannot start a play from the end zone.
Yeah.
And, of course, yeah, the other side of this is I've read enough about Tony Dorsett over the years to know that this guy has had terrible cognitive damage and physical damage from his career in football. He can't remember what he did 10 minutes ago. He has full-time help. And yet he remembers such great detail about what he did on a night in 1979.
Yeah.
And so there is that sort of constant kind of bittersweetness of you know, experiencing that.
Oh, well, I want to ask you specifically sort of what that was like when you finally did start talking to Tom Brady and getting to know him. But let's take another call. Woody is calling from Westwood. Woody, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, thanks. Good to talk to a fellow new tonight. I was wondering, being a diehard patriot, if you had any thoughts about whether Bill Belichick has fallen off the cliff, why he didn't put Butler in, what his relationship is now with Brady and Kraft.
Great question.
So Butler, of course, this is the last Super Bowl.
Yes, Malcolm Butler, the cornerback who was kept on the bench inexplicably, and to this day we don't know why, arguably cost them the game because the Patriots could not, the defense could not get off the field. Look, I think there's a lot of noise now. I mean, there's a new book about Belichick by Ian O'Connor, an ESPN writer, that has a lot of people talking about the frictions between him and Robert Kraft and Brady. I mean, I do think that this Malcolm Butler story, I mean, if you go back 3-4 years and that out-of-nowhere interception he had in the Super Bowl, which was legitimately one of the top 3 or 4 maybe greatest sports moments or NFL moments in a Super Bowl in history. A guy who was a rookie, an undrafted free agent, just coming out of nowhere and just totally changing the game. And then, you know, achieving great success out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden, on the exact same stage, what was it, 2 years later? No, 3 years later, having something inexplicable happen. And look, I, as a fan, resent the fact that Bill Belichick has never explained to us what was going on. Because, look, this is not national security. Everyone cares about it.
He grunted about it a couple of times.
You know what? I don't, as a consumer, I do not appreciate that part of the act.
Yeah.
But look, he's smarter than all of us, so he can do what he wants.
Right. So what was that, what was that meeting with Brady like? Because he's notoriously private. He doesn't do many interviews. You managed to get in there. What was your impression of him?
You know, remarkably normal. I mean, he's not, I mean, for his abnormally talented and good-looking and wealthy and married to a supermodel-y as he is, he's pretty down to earth. He's actually capable of incredible thoughtfulness on topics that he cares about, whether it's training issues and nutrition issues or certainly football issues. He's much more curious than I thought. He actually asked me a ton of questions about what it's like to be around politicians, what politicians are like, because he, I think like a lot of people, thinks that that life is just insane.
Yeah.
I'm like, what does it take to succeed in politics? What do you have to sacrifice? What do you have to go through? Because obviously it's not completely dissimilar to what a sports celebrity has to go through, in that you're very isolated in some ways, you're very pampered in some ways, and you're under a lot of scrutiny in many ways. So I was struck by that. He also is, I don't think it's fully appreciated the degree to which he's just very counterintuitive in how he sees the world. He's caught quite a bit of criticism for his reliance on these alternative diets and medicine and you know, training methods with Alex Guerrero, his somewhat controversial body coach. But ultimately, he's a different kind of thinker. He has always sort of thought, he has a very, Don Yee, his agent, is not a typical NFL agent. He's someone he hired, you know, when he came out of college and is stuck with. Don, who's the one who originally put me in touch with Brady, is someone who, you know, is not a, he's just very, very, he has an Eastern philosophy on things. So Tom is just a, he is willing to take on the industrial complex of football, and I appreciate that.
And what's your take on just his extraordinary longevity? I mean, correlation doesn't mean causation, but he does these weird diets and TB12, and you mentioned Guerrero, and I mean, in one sense, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, here he is at 41, still playing at a top level. What explains that?
I would think a lot of things. I mean, one, obviously, his work ethic is extraordinary. His commitment to this is extraordinary. I think he plays a position that is relatively protected on the field. I think, other than being a kicker, I mean, being a quarterback, given the rules protecting quarterbacks, is a pretty relatively safe proposition, especially Tom is not someone who scrambles. I mean, there have been a lot of quarterbacks that have had a lot of concussion issues, but they were scrambling quarterbacks, like Troy Aikman, Steve Young, Warren Moon, Brett Favre in the 90s. I mean, there's this whole generation of Hall of Fame quarterbacks who have had this, so, or had all kinds of issues. So I think it's luck. I think part of it is also when you get so smart about what you do for a living and are able to release the ball so quickly and are able to think so much quicker than anyone else, you probably afford yourself a lot more physical kind of leeway because you can sort of move around the field more. But look, I think a lot of it is luck, and I think if he takes, God forbid, a really, really serious hit on Sunday against Detroit, it could change the whole thing.
Hmm. I want to ask you, sort of come back to the NFL in general, sort of ask you a sort of big sweeping question about sort of the challenges that the NFL faces, whether it's sort of this political feud with the president, bad PR, concerns around concussions, brain damage. Are they set up, returning to this membership, are they set up in such a way that they can deal with these challenges? And if not, what happens to the NFL?
I think they've been lucky for a long time. I think they've been very powerful for a long time. I think they're a classic example of a monopoly organization that has all kinds of leverage that has benefited them in broadcast contracts, in labor negotiating contracts, and so forth. I think, you know, if I were betting on them, if I were like, if they were a public company, which obviously they're not, but I was buying shares, I think that, like, their recent track record is obviously growth and success and prosperity, but I think there are a lot of serious long-term, you know, lags on their ability to continue to be as successful as they have. I mean, health and safety, the workforce and young people is going to go down considerably, it looks like. And also, if you look at the last few years, there were moments, like in the last 5 years alone, where things just looked like they were spiraling out of control, and they didn't have a clue. The Ray Rice video in 2014.
Right, domestic abuse allegations.
Having a president that tweets, I mean, they don't know what to do. So my basic takeaway here is that the NFL will survive because it's a great game and a great TV sport, but it will do so in spite of the people who run and own it.
Not because of them.
Right.
All right. That's Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. He's author of Big Game, the NFL in Dangerous Times. And Mark will be holding a Q&A tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 p.m. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
And thanks for the book. This is fun.
Okay. That's it. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Joining us now is Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. This is part of a regular check-in with the state's top law enforcer, and there's lots to talk about, from the gas explosions in the Merrimack Valley to politics to her own re-election bid. And Attorney General Healey, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be with you, Anthony.
So you were in the Merrimack Valley this weekend meeting with residents. What did you see? What did you hear that most concerns you? Let me just ask you to move right. There you go.
I think there are a few things. First of all, what did I see? My job was to go up there as the ratepayer advocate and get briefed by the utilities and the gas company. We wanted to understand what happened and what the plan is going forward. Here's what I saw, though. I saw total devastation. Mm. I mean, the needs facing this community, and of course, it's not limited to Lawrence, North Andover, Andover, other areas were impacted. But Lawrence in particular was really, really impacted. And I spent time in the shelters, and these are many people who had very little to begin with. They were worried about things like the food that spoiled in the refrigerator and not being able to afford to go out and buy groceries. So there's tremendous humanitarian need right now in that community. And my office is going to continue to be there as a resource to those victims and to work with others on providing assistance. The other thing, though, that I was struck by was the outpouring of support. First responders, I was talking to a couple of police officers from Somerville and Methuen who had come on scene. There were officers who came from all over Massachusetts. And that response was really heartening and inspiring, as was the number of volunteers. I met a mother and a daughter from Andover who'd come over to help in one of the shelters. I met so many teachers and staff from the Lawrence Public Schools who were working in the shelters over that weekend. And that really is inspiring. But I think we've got a serious issue here. As we go forward, the pipes need to be fixed. We are looking at a situation, it could be weeks, months, where people in Lawrence may be without an ability to have hot water or an ability to cook.
I mean, we're talking about replacing some 48 miles of aging gas pipes, right?
That's a ton of work. And here's what I've said. Yeah. The companies need to do everything they can to get as many experienced gas workers on site to fix this and to fix it in a safe manner. It can't be done too quickly in a way that's not safe. It's got to be done expeditiously but thoroughly. And you need more workers. And that's why I've said if they need to bring back workers, including some of those who've been locked out, now's the time to do it because, you know, people cannot afford to wait. Winter is coming. Obviously, there's going to be a ton of litigation, a ton of claims, a lot to sort out. We as an office will be there protecting consumers, protecting ratepayers. The one thing I don't want to see is any effort by the gas companies to pass on the bill to ratepayers or residents who are already burdened by this.
So I wanted
failure.
To ask you about that. So how does your office sort of make that happen? I mean, how can the state or your office ensure that the cost of upgrading 48 miles of pipeline doesn't get passed on to the consumer?
Well, that's something statutorily we cover. We are the ratepayer advocate for the state. So our job is to be there to protect ratepayers and to make sure they're not unfairly charged. We do that regularly. In fact, we had an open case, a rate case against Columbia Gas going at this time. And what we'll be looking to do is to make sure that there is a full accounting of expenses and a full accounting of what it's going to cost to do these repairs. And we want to make sure that those costs are not passed on to ratepayers. Those costs should be borne, frankly, by the company and its shareholders. Hmm. It's as simple as that, as well as the parent company.
Now, when you mentioned that you had an ongoing case, this was Columbia Gas was in the process of raising rates, right? $33 million, a number they had settled on after negotiating with your office, right?
Right. Originally, they came in much higher. That's what happens. Yeah. The utilities, when they want to raise rates, they have to go before the State Department of Public Utilities. Yeah. We're the party. The AG's office comes in representing you and me, the ratepayers. And we fought the proposed rate increase and ultimately settled at a much lower rate of increase. At this point, that whole settlement has been shelved and has
right.
been
they
pulled back.
As
it should be, because there's a much larger and more serious issue on our hands right now that's going to require a serious look. Also, a thorough investigation by state and federal authorities. We need to get to the bottom of what happened to make sure that the right things are done to fix the system, and most importantly, to take care of residents in the interim. And as I say, there are a lot of people who have been affected, who it looks like will continue to suffer and be affected over what may be several weeks, if not months. The state needs to be there for them.
So this was a catastrophe that afflicted three communities in Massachusetts. But of course, when something like that happens, I think residents all over the state are correct to kind of wonder, could this happen here? Could this happen in my community? I mean, should the state, survey all natural gas companies and pipes and hardware and infrastructure across the state?
Well, I think that's something that the Department of Public Utilities should make sure is happening right now as we speak. I think people are understandably concerned about, what's happening beneath the surface in their own communities and what their risks are. And certainly now is an important time to make sure that those inspections are done and the right steps be taken and the right protocols and practices are in place across the board at all these companies.
I want to move on to a little bit of politics and sort of recent events, starting with Ayanna Pressley and her surprise victory in the Democratic primary. As we know and as we've reported widely, handily beat incumbent Mike Capuano. And she did it despite the fact that much of the Democratic establishment backed Capuano, former Governor Deval Patrick, Mayor Marty Walsh, Congressman Joe Kennedy, former Congressman Barney Frank, even the civil rights icon John Lewis, to name just a few. You were an exception. You backed her from the start. What did you see in her candidacy that all of those other fellow Democrats of yours didn't see?
I know Ayanna Pressley. I have worked with Ayanna Pressley for over 10 years now on so many different issues. I know how much she is going to bring to the 7th and, more importantly, to Washington, D.C., what she's going to stand for, who she's going to fight for. And also I know Ayanna Pressley's ability to energize and mobilize and get stuff done. When I heard that she was facing the establishment against her, frankly, I was reminded a little bit of my own race. I faced a similar scenario years ago when I ran as a first-time candidate for attorney general. Mm-hmm. Ayanna Pressley was one of the few who stood out and supported me when the governor and the mayor supported my opponent. And, I appreciated her courage then. More importantly, though, I appreciate her courage and her willingness to speak out, give a voice to those who are vulnerable, and to speak to issues that I think are really resonating with people in our community. And I think the illustration she used of the number one bus said it all.
Going from Harvard Square to
right?
Dudley Square
and
to
I
Oxford,
think,
yeah.
You know, no matter where you live, and I'm a Boston resident, you get that, right? Mm-hmm. You see, the disparity there. And I think we struggle with, why is this so? And what do we need to do? And Ayanna really spoke to that. In campaigning with her, one of the things that I was really excited about, Anthony, was the fact that so many people were turning out who hadn't been involved in a political campaign before. That's also something that I'm seeing across this state and across this country. It's really good for democracy. It's really good for the Democratic Party. The number of people, this has been a silver lining, frankly, since November 2016. The number of people who are now running for office or involved in political campaigns or stepping up to volunteer, that's a really wonderful and inspiring thing, and that gives me tremendous hope and optimism about what's possible for this country.
Do you think the establishment Democrats, including all those establishment Democrats in this state, who some of whom I listed, who didn't support her candidacy, I mean, is there a message that they need to take away and really take to heart here?
I leave that to all of us individually and to them individually. What I do think is important, though, is that all of us in politics and who are privileged to serve in office never forget it's the people we serve. You know, those are the interests and the only interests that we're beholden to, the interests of our constituents. And, you know, I think that's why people are so fed up with D.C. right now. You know, it's why I support the repeal of Citizens United. It's why we've got to get rid of money in politics and the special interests that seem to control the deck entirely. And I think that what you've seen across this country in election after election recently, and hopefully we're going to see a boatload more of it come November, is the masses coming forward and saying enough is enough, and we're going to take this country back, we're going to take democracy back. And that's what this is about, and I think that's why this time is particularly exciting.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your many legal actions, lawsuits against the Trump administration. I've talked to you about this in the past, but just to sort of bring listeners up to date, and actually I think my numbers might be a little bit out of date, but if I have this right, you have signed on to legal challenges against the Trump administration at least something like 26 times, maybe more, and we're talking about among the actions, challenging Trump's travel ban, his effort to rescind DACA, you sued to protect parts of the Affordable Care Act, to multiple times the Department of Education for failing to protect student lenders from fraud. You've sued or joined other lawsuits against former EPA Chief Scott Pruitt something like 9 times. And the legal battle goes on and on and on. Are you sort of comfortable with this reputation that you've earned? I was described this way, that you're part of the shock troops of the Trump resistance, leading the shock troops of the Trump resistance.
Well, I think what we're trying to do is protect the interests of the residents and the businesses in our state. And that's what I'm trying to do with these litigations. You know, it's important to the people of Massachusetts that we have access to health care, that we support a growing clean energy economy and investments made here that are threatened by the actions that Trump and EPA have taken. It's important to Massachusetts residents that we protect student borrowers and try to keep them safe from predatory lenders and predatory for-profit schools that are out there. Last week, my office won big against Betsy DeVos once again, where we had to go to court to get a judge to order her to not put in place a plan she had to allow those predatory actors back into the marketplace. So, you know, for me, all these lawsuits are about, of course, taking on actions that Donald Trump and his team does that are illegal and unconstitutional, but that harm in real ways folks in Massachusetts. And I think, you know, so far we've had a lot of success in the courts. I hope the day comes, Anthony, where, you know, they stop doing things that are stupid and illegal and harmful, you know. But until then, we're going to keep suing, and we're going to keep stopping them from doing these things while we move ahead with a really robust agenda. You know, I've been spending the last few months visiting classrooms of middle schools all around the state, launching my substance use prevention program, Project Here, which is really directed at combating so much of what we've seen revealed through the opioid crisis. I've got a new initiative on as well to address issues of violence, particularly among young people, on teen dating violence and the like. We're really pushing hard for taxpayers in Massachusetts. I'm proud of the work that our office did last year alone. You know, we generate revenue for the state. My office brought back over $800 million for the state and taxpayers last year.
So the point is, you're doing a lot more, obviously, than just suing the Trump administration.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there are those, she's suing Trump all the time. What's that about? And it's costing us money. First of all, you know, I haven't gotten a single dime more to do this work. This is the work of the office that's necessary to protect Massachusetts interests and our industries. And, you know, I'm grateful to my team in the office because they're working hard on a lot of fronts these days.
Well, let me sort of continue this line of questioning in the context of you're facing a reelection challenge from Republican Jay McMahon. He's an attorney from Cape Cod. And as you know, he makes the case that all of these suits, what he calls them politically motivated, rather than serving the interests of the people of Massachusetts. And we had him in here a few weeks ago. Here's a little bit of what he said, which you've obviously heard before, but here it is.
Those are the only issues she pays attention to. She doesn't do anything at all about public safety. And when you talk, and you were asking us a little while ago about the civil suits that she's been filing against the Trump administration, you only have to look at the first one to see that it's all just a matter of her own political activism. And it is against our public safety interests.
So the first suit he was referring to, obviously, was the suit challenging the travel ban, which eventually was upheld by the Supreme Court. But respond to Jay McMahon's point there.
I have yet to meet Mr. McMahon. I don't know much about my opponent or his record. I do know something about law enforcement. And as a member of law enforcement and the chief law enforcement officer of the state, I'm very proud of our record. You know, one of the things that we did and that we noticed, particularly with what was happening in immigrant communities and things like the travel ban, it was us working with law enforcement that said we need to make sure that we maintain the trust between law enforcement and the communities that we serve. We know who are people out there who are dangerous to our community, and we wanted the federal government to stay out of our way. Give us more resources, you know, to support the men and women who serve, but don't tell us how to do our job. You know, I'm proud to have the endorsement of police officers in this race. I'm proud of the work that I've done with the Massachusetts Police Chiefs Association. I was just with them the other day for their annual conference. So, you know, I'm a big supporter of law enforcement and the work that our first responders do. And, you know, I also have a bigger job in the sense that, you know, I have to look after things like our healthcare institutions. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of the job of the Attorney General. So, you know, while people may question why I'm suing the president, well, you know, when he threatens to sabotage the ACA or cut off Medicaid funds to our state, I have to sue. Why? You know, because otherwise our healthcare markets will be destabilized and health insurance plans will be undermined, and fundamentally people are going to lose access to care. That's unacceptable in the state that pioneered universal access to healthcare. So, you know, there's just as Attorney General, you know, we call ourselves the people's lawyer. You really cover a lot of territory and a lot of ground out there. And what I've said is I've offered debates with my opponent. I welcome him to the race. I welcome those debates, and I look forward to talking through the issues and certainly our record.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're going to be doing a debate here at WBUR between
you
and Mr.
October
McMahon.
24th,
yeah.
I think.
So, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
But so let's put it, and we'll obviously get into this more deeply when you two are seated in here, but putting aside his claims that these suits against the Trump administration are politically motivated, you've responded to that. Is it fair to say that you'd rather be focused on state issues rather than having to defend the state against the federal government?
See, I don't separate them, because anytime there's a federal action, an executive order that has an impact on a Massachusetts college or university, which the travel ban did, by the way, because mm-hmm. literally we had professors and students who were blocked from coming here, or a decision that, you know, like the DeVos decision to let predatory players back into the student lending space, having spent a lot of time going after people who cheated thousands of Massachusetts students here, you know, that's something that is tied to Massachusetts interests. So, you know, that's what that work is about. I wish we had a partner at the federal level. We used to, both through previous Republican and, you know, Democratic administrations. We found ways to work together on a mm-hmm. number of fronts. But what's happened here, and what is so troubling, Anthony, is that as you look across federal agencies, no one's home. No one is there.
What do you mean by that, no one's home? I mean,
no one's home to do their job at the FCC, at the FTC, at the CFPB, anywhere in DOJ. You walk the halls of DOJ, you know, a lot of people have left, and they're not replacing them to enforce laws that are there to protect workers from abuse, or consumers, or seniors from fraud, or students from getting ripped off, or to stand up for civil rights. So what that has meant is that all that work has fallen on states, and particularly state AGs, to do. So, you know, I would hope we'd get to a point, particularly with a turn in elections, that would change. But until then, we've got to be there to be the bulwark to both enforce laws that are there to protect people in, frankly, what has been a complete abdication of responsibility by the federal government.
Let me ask you about another specific issue that you're dealing with. Your suit against ExxonMobil. The Supreme Judicial Court ruled that your investigation into whether Exxon hid knowledge of climate change could go ahead. Exxon wants to take this to the Supreme Court and argues that you don't have the jurisdiction, that it's unconstitutional because Exxon doesn't have a significant enough connection to Massachusetts. What's the response to that claim by Exxon?
Well, I think that's pretty laughable because as your listeners are out there on the road right now, I bet within the next 5 miles they're going to come across an ExxonMobil station somewhere. So, I mean, it's laughable that Exxon would take the position they don't do business in Massachusetts. More importantly, a court has already rejected that claim. Here's something, though, I want to be clear about. You know, a lot of people say, Exxon, you sued Exxon. Well, you know what? I didn't sue Exxon. Exxon sued me. What happened is information came to light that Exxon may have lied to consumers and investors about the impact on fossil fuels was having on the environment back in the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. We sent subpoenas to Exxon asking them for information, straight up normal work of our office. Instead of responding, they sued me in Texas, in New York, and in Massachusetts. We got all those cases dismissed. They want to continue to press it in the Supreme Court. Good luck to them. I'm confident that we'll be able to continue with our investigation. And it's an important investigation. It's important that we get answers. And we're just going to stay the course here.
We literally have sort of 10 seconds left in this interview. But what is the most important question that you need an answer to from Exxon?
What happened? Yeah. Give us the documents. Let us do our work. And stop playing games and stonewalling.
All right. Well, that's Attorney General Maura Healey. She's going to be back on October. You have the date. I don't have it in my head.
I think it's the 24th. All right. Whatever it is, I look forward to being
here. We haven't confirmed. I'm told by my
questions.
Producers we have not confirmed it yet, but it is coming up. She's going to be back on Radio Boston soon with her Republican opponent, Jay McMahon. Maura Healey, thank you so much for coming today. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Finally today, the Red Sox have another chance tonight in New York to clinch the American League Eastern Championship. They just need to beat the Yankees and they can raise another banner. A banner, by the way, that went missing for a couple of days this week. Then a guy named Louis Yacuzzi of Malden revealed that he had it. He told the Boston Globe that he found the banner, you know, like you do on McGrath Highway in Somerville. And if you missed it, check out the video that the Globe made of Yacuzzi and his buddy James Amaral. It's like a hostage video in which the two guys are offering to return the banner to the Red Sox if the team, you know, if the team does the right thing.
We want to give it back to them because it belongs to them and it doesn't belong to us. Yep. But in reciprocation, we would like, you know, maybe to go to a nice playoff game or we're looking for something. We just don't want to hand it over to them.
We're hoping they do the right thing. Yep. You know, we did the right thing. We could have kept it. We could have put it on eBay. We could, you know, we got connections where we could have reached out to other sources.
Yeah, it's a very nice banner. It'd be a shame to see something bad happen to it. Well, apparently it didn't work out the way Louis Yacuzzi and James Amaral had hoped. Yesterday, the Red Sox confirmed they got the banner back, and they didn't give anything to the people who returned it. So now that it's back, all the Red Sox need to do tonight is beat the Yankees. So that's it. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.